Numidia Beat on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio. I'm Krista Rockwitz.
And I'm Angeles Neri. Krista, what's on Numidia Beat today?
We have 8 great media news stories to share with you today.
From the Nile, what is InfoNile?
InfoNile is a cross-border journalist project that covers water news in the nations bordering the Nile.
From Russia,
Putin's government is using the law to crack down on dissent in Russia. How have Russia's foreign agent laws kept political opposition on the defense? Are other authoritarian governments using foreign agent laws to stifle independent organizations?
From Argentina,
our journalists and the press being treated by the government of Javier Milei. Is Milei at war with the Argentine press?
From the UK,
does BBC still dominate TV screens in the United Kingdoms? Or is Netflix winning the streaming war? Are the global streaming giants a threat to British media in the UK?
From Russia,
why does the Russian military have its own TV channel? It's called Zvezda TV. Why is Zvezda TV using artificial intelligence to create a political satire show mocking American politicians?
From India,
Indian politics are very complicated. Political polarization is a problem in India. What about the media? Are the media polarized as well?
From China,
there is a digital divide in China. What is the digital divide? Can the Chinese government bridge this digital divide, or are many people in China being left behind?
All this and more coming up on OWWR Old Westbury Radio, streaming live from the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. Let's begin with a report about investigative reporting in Africa by Heidi Simpebwa. An innovative group of reporters has been covering a broad swath of Africa called the Nile Basin. This news organization is called InfoNile. Heidi, get us started with a little geography. InfoNile reports on a region called the Nile Basin. Where is that?
So the Nile Basin is a drainage area in northeastern Africa that covers 11 countries.
What is InfoNile and what issues does it focus on?
InfoNile is a geojournalism platform that reports on environmental, climate, water and biodiversity issues across the Nile River Basin. It focuses on cross-border stories involving water scarcity, pollution, deforestation, dams, and the human impact of climate change. It also uses data-driven storytelling, maps, and multimedia tools.
Who funded InfoNile and why was it created?
InfoNile was co-funded by Frederick Majira, a Ugandan environmentalist, and Annika McGuinness. It was created to bridge the gap between science and journalism. It gives visibility to underreported water and climate issues. And it also encourages collaboration among journalists in the 11 countries sharing the Nile Basin.
How is InfoNile funded and supported?
So InfoNile receives funding from several media and environmental organizations, including the JRS Biodiversity Foundation and the Pulitzer Center, Internews, and Code for Africa. These funds support training, data collection, journalist and scientist collaborations, and cross-border investigative projects.
What impact has InfoNile had in the region?
So InfoNile has trained over 250 journalists, produced hundreds of investigative stories, and fostered great collaboration among reporters, scientists, and local communities. Its investigations have influenced policy discussions, improved environmental awareness, and encouraged enforcement of conservation laws across East Africa. For New Media Beat, I am Heidi Simpewa. Back to you, Annelise.
Thank you, Heidi. Have you heard of geocaching? Thousands around the world are participating. Kelvin Zales is here to explain geocaching for New Media Beat. Kelvin, what is geocaching?
To break it down to bare basics, a geocache is an item or items that are hidden somewhere with the coordinates posted online. Geocachers, as they can be called, use GPS coordinates to travel and to locate the geocache. They can also be the ones who hide a geocache too. When they, a geocacher, find the cache, they can log their visit in a logbook and exchange an item in the cache for an item they have bought. In addition to holding small items, geocaches often contain a logbook, where those who have found the cache log their success and pass on a few words to the cache's creator. The Geocaching Association of Great Britain expands on this aspect, reporting that, quote, "These logs are important for the geocache hider. It is part of their reward for hiding the cache."
Why is this hobby centered online?
To explain it, GPS accuracy was heightened in the year 2000. Kind of like starts the origins of geocaching as a whole because of that. Dave Ulmer took advantage of these heightened accuracies. He stored a black bucket filled with a few trinkets, including a can of beans, in the wilderness beside Beaver Creek, Oregon. And Ulmer shared the coordinates in an email to a group of friends who were also interested in the GPS technology. And thus, geocaching was born. It started online and it remains there to this day.
Why is this hobby global?
Websites dedicated to geocaching started relatively early, with the first one appearing in late 2000. And international websites following suit throughout the next couple of years have also become very popular. Bryden Whedon, a space policy expert at the Aerospace Corporation Center for Space Policy and Strategy, spoke about geocaching in an interview with Scientific American, an American science magazine. He attributes the growth of geocaching to improvements in global GPS technology. One of the most popular social media sites is one that is just purely dedicated to geocaching, known as geocaching.com. This website is owned by a private company called Groundspeak, and their app contains a worldwide map of geocaches. So because geocaching is a primarily online hobby, it was really easy for it to spread globally, especially when GPS got better as technology. And having a website and app that just has that global map where people can upload these geocaches really helped it spread.
How do people connect online?
Like I mentioned, geocaching is an international hobby. There are geocachers and geocaches all around the world. The geocaching app itself unlocked a new way for international users to share caches. Geocachers also use traditional social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, X, and it gives them a platform to share experiences, locations, and form new connections.
How do these connections translate to real life?
There's a lot of ways that it does translate to real life. For example, Argentina's Esperanza base in Antarctica has a very in-depth geocache. While it only contains a hidden logbook and no items, the cache encourages users to travel to one of the world's most remote places for an adventure. The same sense of international camaraderie can be found in other geocaches. The Greetings from Poland geocache, despite its name, is located in Jakarta, Indonesia. It was placed in 2013 by a geocaching user from Poland, and since then it has garnered visits from local Indonesians, other Polish visitors, and many more international visitors from as far away as the Netherlands. Even after more than a decade since its placement, this cache is still visited regularly. These caches are just some of the many examples of how truly global and unifying the hobby is. Without the internet, geocaching as a concept likely would have never taken form. For New Media Beat, I'm Kelvin Zales. Back to you, Angeles.
Thanks, Kelvin. It's almost time to talk about Russia with my co-host, Krista Rakowicz. What do we know about foreign agent laws? How are they used by authoritarian governments to control political dissent?
Laws have been weaponized to harass independent organizations that criticize the government. Russia is not the only nation using foreign agent laws for political control. Did you know that the United States had its own foreign agent laws since 1938? In the U.S., there are no penalties for registered foreign agents. It is mostly about transparency so that Americans can know when a foreign power is trying to influence them. In other nations like Putin's Russia, the laws are punitive. Anna Lesnieri is here to explain. Let's start with a basic question. What are foreign agent laws?
Foreign agent laws require individuals or organizations that receive money, support, or even just have ties to foreign countries to register with the government as foreign agent. Everything they publish, such as websites, articles, etc., must be labeled as foreign agent. They're also forced to submit detailed financial reports and are subject to regular inspections. If they don't comply, they can face fines or even criminal charges.
How is it connected to Russia?
It all started in Russia back in 2012 when the government introduced its first version of the law targeting NGOs, which mean non-government organizations with foreign funding. But since then, it has expanded dramatically. In April 2025, the Moscow Times reported that President Vladimir Putin signed a new amendment that allows the government to label almost anyone with connections to foreign organizations as a foreign agent, even if they've never taken money.
Who's being labeled as foreign agent?
It's no longer just NGOs or human rights groups. It now includes journalists, independent media outlets, activists, and even ordinary citizens who share political opinions online. According to Human Rights Watch and the Moscow Times, independent journalists and media outlets like Medusa, NGOs like Memorial, which is a Nobel Peace Prize winning organization, activists and public figures, and even ordinary citizens are being labeled. For Russia, this is a way to maintain control over its people and what they can see. For New Media Beat, I'm Angela Znary. Back to you, Krista.
Thank you, Angeles. Our next story is about press freedom in Argentina. Adam Platez has a report on how press freedom has been changing under the government of Javier Milei. Adan, introduce us to Javier Milei.
Thank you, Krista. Well, to give you context as to what's happening in Argentina at the moment, Argentina has experienced a significant decline in press freedom, from ranking 40th to 87th in the World Press Freedom Index by Reporters Without Borders. The ability to exercise and publish media in Argentina is limited because of the current president, Javier Milei.
Who is responsible for the decline of press freedom in Argentina?
The decline of press freedom in Argentina can be traced back to Javier Milei and his administration. Javier Milei is the current president of Argentina who won back in 2023. Milei's relationship with the media and the press has always been tense. Milei despises the work ethic of journalists and does not hesitate to critique them. According to Reporters Without Borders, Milei has referred to journalists as ignorant, imbeciles, donkeys, even freeloaders. When he used to be a TV commentator, obviously, but Milei further makes his views on journalists clear when he stated that they are the ones showing the reality that you journalists never let be seen because you have a monopoly on the microphones, as reported by the Colombian news source, the Colombian Journalism Review. Another notable statement of his is from a tweet stating, "We don't hate journalists enough."
What measures has Milei taken to oppress?
Well, Milei and his administration have gone as far as banning news outlets from publishing certain media. For example, there are audio recordings that were attributed to Karina Milei, Javier Milei's sister, that the Argentine government has determined to prevent from being published. The recordings were deemed a threat to privacy and honor of the security general and the nation's institutional security, as said by Alejandro Patricio, as reported by Reporters Without Borders.
Who are some notable journalists that have been attacked by Milei?
Milei has attacked countless journalists. A very notable example is of his administration going after journalists is of the journalist Mauro Federico. According to Reporters Without Borders, Federico and his media outlet Carnaval were targeted by the Ministry of Security with requested raids for their publication of audio files attributed to Karina Milei. Another notable journalist is Roberto Navarro. Navarro was assaulted by unidentified individuals when he went to attend a meeting in a hotel, as reported by Argentina Reports. Although Milei isn't directly responsible for what happened to Navarro, this is an example of how his animosity towards journalists can influence other people to think the same way.
How have Milei's actions affected press freedom in Argentina?
Press freedom in Argentina has dropped drastically ever since Milei took office. Argentina went from being in the top 40 countries in the world to dropping 47 places in the RSF Press Freedom Index with 1 year. Milei's administration has limited press freedom to the point where just being a journalist or working for any media source feels unsafe. It's now a common practice for the government to dismantle and weaken public media. For example, according to the Buenos Aires Times in Argentina, President Javier Milei stigmatized journalists, dismantled public media outlets, and used state advertising as a political weapon. Press freedom in Argentina may continue to be under attack as Milei's party, La Libertad Avanza, has recently won the midterm election on October 26, 2025, as reported by the Buenos Aires Times. For New Media Beat, I'm Adán Pleites. Back to you, Krista.
Thank you, Adán. We have media news from the United Kingdom next. I will be reporting on the British Broadcasting Corporation's competition with the streaming giants of the world. Are British viewers switching to Netflix? What can the BBC and other British TV networks do about the competition from streaming platforms owned by international corporations like Netflix and Google?
Let's talk about TV in the UK with my co-host, Krista Rockowitz. There is a global competition for viewers between the new streaming platforms and the legacy broadcasting networks like the BBC. If the future of television is streaming online, What are national broadcasters supposed to do? Should governments protect their national media against the foreign competition from giant American companies like Netflix, Google, and Amazon? Should British TV be British? How is the BBC meeting this challenge? Is the BBC still the most popular choice in the UK? Krista, how are people watching TV in the UK today?
Well, the BBC is still the most popular way to watch TV, but more and more streaming services like Netflix and YouTube are becoming extremely popular. Netflix recently became the second most watched network in the UK over BBC Channel 1.
What does the rising popularity of Netflix in the UK reveal about the changing audience preferences?
In January 2025, Netflix ranked at the top for the UK's most watched television source. This reveals that audiences, especially younger viewers, prefer on-demand, personalized, and ad-free entertainment. This new way of viewing content is convenient, and young people can access media on their own schedule rather than tuning in for fixed broadcasting times. Streaming platforms offer more diverse content, global choices, and of course the ability to binge watch, which appeals to the modern individual's viewing habits.
How can the BBC keep younger viewers engaged?
Well, to keep younger viewers engaged, the BBC could expand its digital presence on iPlayer. They could offer reliable content for younger people, and the BBC could also further develop their social media presence with like streaming style formats to make themselves more accessible and relevant to younger audiences.
Is the BBC forming alliances with other UK media companies to counter the power of global streaming giants?
Facing global streaming competition, the BBC has been contemplating what strategic partnerships they can make within the UK media landscape and beyond to sustain its reach on the public. There has been a proposal for BBC and Channel 4 to merge, where the networks would share classic TV shows on a streaming platform. Channel 4 is a separate, self-funded public service broadcaster known for its diverse and often challenging programming. This potential merge has faced backlash, and Channel 4 rejects the suggestion of any merger. CEO Alex Mahone argued that the unique structure of competition between publicly funded and commercially funded broadcasters is what makes the UK public service TV so excellent.
Has the BBC made partnership with Netflix / other streaming services?
Well, Netflix and the BBC have aligned to produce many series that are created and streamed in the UK as well as the US. One of the most popular series is called Peaky Blinders, which is a worldwide phenomenon that has boosted UK tourism and boosted its global reach. Production for the new series of Peaky Blinders is supported by the West Midlands Combined Authority, and it's the first commission following the new BBC partnership agreement with WMCA and Create Central. For New Media Beat, I'm Krista Rakowitz. Back to you, Anjelis.
Thanks, Krista. Craig Young is in Studio A today to talk about Russian media. Craig, you have a report about a Russian TV show. It is a political satire called Politstacker. There are a couple of interesting things about this TV show that make it news. The first is that it is supposedly created using generative artificial intelligence. And the second interesting aspect is who owns the TV channel that produces Politstacker. Craig, what is the name of this TV channel and who owns it?
The name of the TV channel is Zvezda TV. The company who owns Zvezda TV is the Russian Ministry of Defense.
What is the main technique used to mock Western leaders?
Technique of Zvezda uses is bad AI deepfakes, like a deepfake of Donald Trump who wants to build a Moscow casino with golden toilets.
Why is the show considered a pivotal moment?
It's the first time my state-backed national network has officially designated a long-form program as AI-generated. For New Media Beat, I'm Craig Young. Back to you, Anjelis.
Thank you, Craig. We have media news from India and China up next on New Media Beat. How polarized are the media in India, and is there a digital divide in China? What is a digital divide? Stay tuned to find out.
Stephanie Mazur has been looking at media in India for New Media Beat. Stephanie, you're here to talk about media polarization. Can you explain that to us? What is media polarization?
Media polarization can best be described as journalists or news organizations aligning themselves with a certain political party, group of people, or a way of thinking. This almost always leads to a more biased way of getting your daily news. So in India specifically, many media outlets are aligning themselves with the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is a conservative political party. This has led to a big separation between independent outlets and those that are pro-government.
In what ways have journalists self-centered their work in India?
A lot of journalists in India have recently been self-censoring their work by avoiding certain touchy or investigative topics. So they basically have to be careful to avoid covering certain topics that deal with sensitive issues that can be perceived in various ways, and by picking their words carefully to ensure that they can maintain their platforms.
How does self-censorship connect to media polarization?
Since self-censorship occurs when journalists filter their own published work out of fear of the backlash they may receive, whether that backlash be from political personnel or their advisors, there's a direct link to the media polarization. When the media polarization increases, these journalists feel a lot of pressure to adhere to those specific narratives.
How does the polarization of media affect citizens of India?
This issue has done numbers on how trustworthy society is of their sources. Since many of these platforms avoid any reporting that is too critical, it leaves a lot of citizens skeptical on whether they are getting the whole truth to the story. The polarization has also led to many residents turning to social media for their news information, as it's a lot quicker with multiple sources and sides to the story readily available. For New Media Beat, I'm Stephanie Mazur. Back to you, Krista.
Thank you, Stephanie. Is everyone online in China? Is every person connected? Or are some people in China being left behind because they don't have access to a high-speed internet connection that we all take for granted? Jillian Schaefer has our explainer on the digital divide in China. Before we can understand the digital divide in China, we need to understand the concept itself. Jillian, what do you mean by a digital divide? Can you define it for us?
So the digital divide is the gap between people who have access to technology and the people who do not have access to technology. It depends on factors such as income, education, or where someone lives, and it can affect opportunities in areas like work, learning, and communication.
How will the divide in China divide the rural and urban communities?
The digital divide in China makes the gap between rural and urban communities even wider. In cities, people usually have faster internet, better devices, and more digital opportunities, where rural areas still struggle with weak connections and limited access to technology. This means that people living in big cities can benefit more from online services, jobs, and communications, while rural communities may be left behind.
How might this divide affect access to education?
This divide has a big impact on education because many schools and learning programs now depend on online tools. In cities, students use virtual classes to their advantage and use digital textbooks and access to global resources, but students in rural areas may not have the same access. Without strong internet or updated devices, they can easily fall behind with their urban peers. The unequal access limits their chances to develop digital skills that are now essential in most jobs, making it harder for rural students to compete in China's modern day economy.
Could their divide change how the rest of the world views China's progress in technology?
Their divide could definitely affect how the world sees China's technological process. While China is known for its advantages in artificial intelligence, 5G, and e-commerce, the divide shows that not everyone in the country benefits from these improvements. Other countries may see China's progress as uneven, impressive in major cities like Beijing or Shanghai, but less developed in rural regions. This could make global media question whether China's tech grows is truly representing their nation as a whole or just its urban centers.
What role do government projects play in narrowing this divide?
The government projects play an important role in closing China's digital divide. The Chinese government has launched programs to expand internet coverage, improve rural infrastructure, and provide digital training for local communities. These efforts aim to make online services, education, and business more accessible in less developed areas. By supporting rural internet development and encouraging technologies to invest outside major cities, the government helps create a more balanced digital society. If these projects succeed, China could strengthen its image as a leader, and not only in technology, but also in digital equality. For New Media Beat, I'm Jillian Schaefer. Back to you, Krista.
Thank you, Jillian. That's it for New Media Beat this week. Thanks for listening to New Media Beat. Our show is produced by Kelvin Zales, Emily Savalos, and Jalal McCoy. Jalal McCoy engineered the show this week. My co-host is Angelus Neri.
Today, we heard reports from Stephanie Mazur, Angelus Neri, Adam Platez, Krista Rockowitz, Heidi Sempebwa, Jillian Schaefer, Craig Young, and Kelvin Zales.
New Media Beat is brought to you by OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio and the Media and Communications Department here at the State University of New York at Old Westbury.
For more media news and resources, check out our latest posts at newmediabeat.org, where you can listen to all our podcasts.
وقتی هستی عاشق هستم، وقتی دستاتو میذاری تو دستم، وقتی نیستی